It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 8th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We're broadcasting live from Netroots Nation 2012. Our continuing coverage, and with me right now, it is a pleasure to welcome Senator Jeff Merkley.
Great to be with you.
Thank you very much. It's so rare I'm able to. I know it's very loud in here. I apologize for that. Very loud in here. I apologize for that. Senator, first off, let me start by asking you about one of the things that you've been working on and that is particularly relevant in the past couple of weeks. And that, of course, is the essentially the new Volcker Rule and working on this loophole to deal with the type of losses and the type of gambling, essentially, that banks like J.P. Morgan have been engaging in, particularly J.P. Morgan. We don't know exactly how much they lost. The figure seems to be growing.
Yes, it does.
As we speak. But talk to us about that.
Well, you can think of the Volcker Rule as a firewall between traditional banking that takes deposit and makes loans and hedge funds that do high-risk investing around the world. And there's a whole number of reasons you want that firewall in place. For one, banks that are diverting deposits into hedge fund are not making loans to families and small business. And yet, that is an essential component of our economy. And I can tell you, small business across this country are desperate to find lending. A second is, if you let the conventional banks end up in the hedge fund world, when the hedge fund side blows up, it blows up the banks, and that does damage to our entire economy. Causes everything to seize up, if you will, like we saw in 2008. And finally, we're subsidizing this. We insure deposits for banks, and we provide access to very cheap loans from the Federal Reserve. And there's no reason in the world that we, the taxpayers, should be subsidizing hedge funds. So let them blow up on their own, by themselves, do no damage to the rest of the economy when that happens.
The effectiveness of the Volcker, I mean, we don't even really know in many respects what the Volcker Rule is yet, because regulators are still working that out. But in terms of, philosophically speaking, is there something problematic with having a series of rules as opposed to something like Glass-Steagall, which a series of rules can be chipped away at, and you have lobbyists who and different banking, influences on our legislative making that can sort of make the Swiss cheese as opposed to sort of not even making a cheese,
yes.
Putting some type of...
No, actually, they're very closely related. Glass-Steagall was a firewall between commercial banks, which means a traditional bank, and investment banks, ones who put together securities and that sort of thing, make markets. In this case, the firewall is between traditional banks and hedge funds. In both cases, you need regulators who are going to fiercely enforce the firewall. What we had in Glass-Steagall is it was eroded over 20 years by regulators who stopped regulating, and then it was finally thrown out when it was so weak it almost didn't exist. In this case, what you have is a very closely related firewall. You might call it a new Glass-Steagall. We should have probably called it Glass-Steagall 2 or something. But it won't work either unless the regulators are fierce in defending it.
And what is your sense of how that rulemaking process is going? I mean, do you think you're going to end up with a set of rules that are sort of what you...
That really honor the firewall, protect the firewall? I'm very worried we won't, because ultimately it's up to the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, the OCC. They regulate the big, powerful banks that are in this world of, and want to be in this world of, hedge funds. And if the OCC does not issue rules that basically keep this clearly in place, then we will have lost the battle. So we have a captured agency. A captured agency that for 2 years has been working on rules, but has been putting all kinds of loopholes into those rules to undermine the firewall. So I'm very concerned about that. We do have hope, and that is because J.P. Morgan has renewed the debate, made a public example of why you don't want a hedge fund inside a bank. It's pretty common sense to Americans. They get it. But we're up against hundreds of very well-paid lawyers working day and night to work with the OCC to undermine it.
Have we seen enough from the Department of Justice in terms of pursuing the fraud that took place that essentially brought us to this financial crisis? You know, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I couldn't quite hear you with the background.
Yeah,
I apologize.
No. Give me your thoughts on what the Justice Department has been doing in terms of the seemingly lack of interest in pursuing any of the fraud that went on during this time.
Yeah, there's been very little done. You can kind of think of a lot of what happened with mortgages, the securitization of mortgages, fraudulent practices in which things were sold to customers that the seller knew were going to go bad, had designed to go bad even, but very, very little criminal activity. The Justice Department has focused really on the civil side. Partly because of the complexity of these activities, partly because a lot of what was done was actually legal due to deregulation, and partly because of political motivation of not getting mired down in it for years. Those were judgment calls. I think we do have a huge problem.
Is it really a political cost, though?
It is huge.
The electric to the notion of, like, hey, you know, I'm really upset that the Department of Justice spent all this time on pursuing the guys who crashed the economy. I mean, what?
Yes.
Is there a political cost there?
Oh, there absolutely is. Because you think of the ordinary person who does something wrong and steals a few dollars going to prison, and you think of big, powerful firms that took not just millions but billions of dollars with no one touched, and you know, they're laughing all the way to their Swiss bank account.
Right, the political cost is on the side of doing nothing.
Yes, yes.
Speaking of doing nothing, Senator Reid just came out recently and essentially said, this is about as close as you can get to, you were right, I'm sorry, that I think you could hear in public.
Yeah.
But in terms of the filibuster, he basically said, Senator Merkley was right, we needed to reform the filibuster. Do you think that it's possible that's going to happen in the future?
Yes, I do. We had 46 folks who voted for a combination of reforming the filibuster and protecting the rights of the minority to make amendments. 46 is not 51. We didn't have the leadership with us of either side. But this next time, I think after this 2 years of paralysis, this 2 years of frustration, 2 years of gridlock, the partisanship accelerated, I think we may get to that 51.
Is that going to be a function of having a Democratic majority? Or do you think that it's possible that it will happen with a Republican majority?
I think it's possible in both cases, because the general case that the five reforms that I packaged together in partnership with Tom Udall, the basic case is there's something in this for everyone. That is, the majority gets the ability to strip away frivolous filibusters. But see, we allowed the talking filibuster. That is, created this, replaced the silent filibuster. If you are going to object to a simple majority vote, if you're going to insist more, there should be more debate, there must be more debate. If at any moment there is not somebody who wants to debate, you automatically go to a final majority vote.
What do you say to people who say, you know, if we look just on a numbers level, Republicans are going to control the Senate, perhaps, not just in 2013, but 6 years out, maybe 12 years out, because of how many Democrats are coming up for re-election in the, in the 2 years from now.
Yeah.
So how do you respond? Like, why would we choose this time from a democratic perspective of disarmament?
Well, because it's not disarmament. The talking filibuster still allows one to block something that's important to block, as opposed to just paralyze on routine issues. Second is, the reforms that we put forward give the minority the ability to make amendments, guaranteed. And so there's a lot in it for us if we're in the minority. We retain, we designed this so that we could advocate for it, whether we're in the majority or the minority. It'd be good process. It makes people stand up, and if they're going to paralyze the Senate, they got to do it before the American people.
They've got to own it.
You got to own it, and people can see what the source is. The public can say, hey, they're heroes for blocking it, or they're bums.
So let me ask you, I want to turn to another issue that I know that it's worried me and it's worried my audience. There's a lot of talk of the grand bargain. We are heading towards this fiscal cliff that people are talking about. This real concern amongst people who listen to my program that no matter what happens with the election in November, and perhaps even particularly if President Obama is reelected, that there's going to be a move to cut Social Security, to either raising the retirement age or by decreasing the cost of living expenses. Give me your perspective on where you stand on that and how likely you think it is to happen.
I think it's unlikely. And I'll tell you why. The Social Security Trust is solvent for another 25 years. If you're going to make a small adjustment now to make sure it's solvent for a longer period of time, you raise the level of income that is subject to the Social Security tax. Right now it's $106,000. You can raise it. So there's no justification of increasing the retirement age. There is no justification in creating an artificial COLA, cost of living adjustment, that is not tied to the expenses that seniors experience. We do have a real problem with the Medicare Trust Fund, but Social Security has been a false argument from the time that George Bush raised it. I think that when people start to really consider the details, they're not going to change it.
When are people going to start to consider the details if they don't know that already? I mean, surely they must know that, right? I mean, because I know that.
So
I don't work in the Senate.
So why do you think this keeps coming up on Social Security?
Well, from my perspective, I think you cut Social Security now, you don't have upward pressure on taxes to pay back the trust fund. The longer you can extend the life of the trust fund, the less you have to worry about paying it back. And so I think this is because, essentially, there is a big push to redistribute wealth upwards in this country.
You know, I thought what you're going to argue was that this push keeps coming from those folks who want to privatize Social Security and take the big fees off changing the structure. But I can tell you this. I do a ton of town halls. There is no support investing.
Why are we hearing this? Why do we hear that reporting that President Obama put that on the table with Speaker Boehner? Why do we hear that the only thing that's stopping that from happening, that type of grand bargain, the one that is outlined in Simpson-Bowles, say, the only thing that's stopping it from happening is Republicans' intransigence on revenue increases. They don't want any taxes raised. Why do we have to rely on the intransigence of the Republicans to save Social Security?
Your point's well taken. And the reason I guess I'm more confident that Social Security won't be tabled is the fundamental argument is flawed that's being brought to bear on it. And so
so you think rationality is going to
I don't, I'm a hopeless optimist about the actual pros and cons of the policy debate having weighing in some real way.
What do you make of the seemingly shifting of the line being drawn in the sand about allowing certain Bush tax cuts to expire? We've seen sort of this progression where now Nancy Pelosi has come out for the tax cuts will only expire above the first $1 million as opposed to above the first $250,000.
Yeah, no, I'm very concerned about it. It deeply changes the revenue, the amount of revenue involved. And I live in a world, I live in a working class neighborhood. $250,000 is a ton of money. Nobody makes that kind of money in the world I live in. And there's a big difference between, quote, being a millionaire and making $1 million a year, which is a multi-millionaire.
Right.
So I hope that that line does not move, but I'm very concerned that, you know, many of my colleagues, they come from a world where they're surrounded by people who make vast amounts, and I think have kind of lost touch with how much $250,000 is.
And it's not like, you know, it's graduated tax, so it's that
right.
money that kicks in at that point. We are talking to Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon. We need to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
What's up, person listening to The Majority Report? This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. They're the internet's leading provider of audiobooks. They've got more than 100,000 downloadable titles. They've got all types of literature, fiction, nonfiction, memoir, whatever, all the different types of literature, and many audio versions of New York Times bestseller. You, as a listener to The Majority Report, can get a free Audible book at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. We have the link on majority.fm. You can pick up Ryan Grimm's book, This Is Your Country on Drugs, The Secret History of Getting High in America. That's at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Get a free audiobook and help the show.
We are back with Senator Jeff Merkley from Oregon. Do you think that something's going to be done in the lame duck? In other words, do you think that there is enough of a push to make this some type of grand bargain in that it could possibly happen during lame duck?
So I'm telling folks, don't take a vacation this year. You'll enjoy Thanksgiving dinner, but enjoy religious holidays over the break. But wake up the next morning and be paying attention, because so many things are happening. The expiration of not just the Bush tax cuts, but you got the estate tax coming up. You've got the unemployment insurance. You have the debt ceiling. You've got all these pieces that have a clock ticking. All the tax extenders on things like clean energy that I care about. All these things are tied up. So there's going to be a huge, intense conversation. I and others try to get that conversation going during this year to prepare for basically a thoughtful policy dialogue or proposals. It just seems like that's been impossible, and so we're going to see a lot of backroom deals being cut.
Don't the Democrats have the leverage, though? I mean, if they want it? Because all these things are going to happen automatically. Right? I mean, we're seeing the sequestration is going to happen. The Republicans supposedly don't want this to happen because they don't want any cuts to defense. The tax cuts are all going to expire. Surely the Democrats could come back in 2013 and say, now we're going to offer all the Bush tax cuts have expired. Now we're going to offer a middle class tax cut. If that is the reason why you wouldn't want those taxes to
substantial
expire.
Substantial leverage. You got to have the guts to use it. You got to take your case to the American people.
Do you think that your colleagues have those guts to use it?
I don't want to speak for my colleagues.
I
just want to say that, you know, there's been some battles where I thought deals were struck prematurely rather than taking the case to the people and carrying the fight. And so I said, having seen it happen before, it could happen again. And that's why it's going to be so important for progressive organizations to be paying attention during the time of the year you don't normally have to
right.
pay so much attention.
All right, let me ask you, because it continues to be in the news, and it continues to reach a crisis point in Syria. We have a situation now with what's happening in Syria that looks like it's heading to being a even broader regional issue. What is your sense of what we should be doing in Syria?
Well, let me just start by saying it's so deeply troubling because when you have a government that's putting artillery shells into cities and many other forms of warfare against populations, it's a crime against humanity. I am really perplexed about how the U.S. should engage. We don't have the Arab League asking the U.S. to intervene. We don't have NATO saying that they're going to take a leadership role. You do not have a clear definition of who the good guys and bad guys are and who's what policies they're going to pursue. And it's very, very hard to simply shut down a civil war in progress. The peacekeepers and the failure of the peacekeepers to be able to do that, of course, that was the hope. That's clearly not working. So I'm looking for answers, and if you have any, help me out here.
Well, I mean, I think it obviously should start, hopefully, getting the Russians on board with removing Assad.
And they have moved some, but I don't think they're there yet.
Right. Is it going to take the United States to maybe promise we won't sell Syria weapons? You can continue to have that customer? I mean, to any extent, are you aware of conversations like that? I mean, presumably, Russia doesn't have an attachment to Assad as much as they have an attachment to a client state. So, are you? Is there any sense that that our government is willing to say we understand this is your client state?
My impression is the State Department is deeply engaged with Russia on this. Our team is enormously frustrated at this point, asking the same questions that you and I are asking about what type of role could the U.S. or U.S. and Russia together play. You have a very powerful central government military structure, enormously well armed. It would help enormously for Russia because of the key role that they played to be on board. And that may be our best hope at this point.
Interesting. I want to, tell you that I appreciate the work that you're doing and for spending some time with us. Particularly this work on the Volcker Rule, I hope it... I hope the output of this process, as they begin to sort of create these rules, looks like what the input was as it went into this process.
Well, I'll tell you, the draft rules sure don't right now, and so.
What can be done over the course of that process? I mean, if you have a regulatory structure that is that corrupted. What can be done? I mean, that's the only reason why I would say, I'm suggesting, a broader, brighter line, one that can't be manipulated so much by regulators. I mean, if you can't be, the same company, you can't be the same company.
Yes. Well, I would like to say that it was that simple. However, having seen how the regulators undermined Glass-Steagall before... Uh-huh. If you don't have regulators who view that as their role in the world to keep the companies accountable to the rules, once they're captured, it almost doesn't matter where the rules started. Even the rules could be great, but if they're not enforced or selectively enforced, et cetera, so it's just essential that we have an Office of the Comptroller of Currency.
But how do you get there from here? I mean, if this has been an ongoing problem for 25 years within our regulatory structures, I mean, how do we impact that?
Well, one, you get a new person to head the agency, and we now have that. So holding that person accountable, he was testifying before the Banking Committee 2 days ago. I went over the core arguments on why you need this firewall, why we passed this firewall, asked him if he understood those pieces, and he basically dodged the questions. But my hope is that by you all do, and that we do to try to highlight this issue, that he'll feel like he has the political mandate to design the rules right and enforce them.
Is that the way it works? Is that he doesn't feel he has the political mandate? I mean, is he worried about overstepping the boundaries that may be set for him coming from the executive branch?
He lives in a team where the team all has roots in Wall Street, deeply interconnected. That's how agencies become captured over time. So he's going to have to take a team that's been very dedicated to eroding the rules and bring them around to a different philosophy. And that's going to take a lot of house cleaning. There's going to be a lot of protesting by the powerful on Wall Street. And so the more support he has from Congress and the more support he has from the president, the more likely that he'll be able to pursue that path.
So he's got obstacles in terms of people who are below him on the flow chart. Does he have obstacles on people who are above him on the flow chart?
I wouldn't call it obstacles, but I would say that it's essential that the Treasury Secretary and the Federal Reserve and the other regulators other than the OCC kind of who are in this conversation together. Even the OCC is the final regulator for those large banks. The other regulators and the way that they're presenting themselves is going to matter a lot.
And how encouraged are you that they're going to be pushing him in the right direction?
Well, I've talked with several of the regulators who are absolutely on board for a strong firewall, who think it's essential to the future, but they also know it's not their portfolio.
Right.
So right now they're trying to do rules that all five of the regulatory groups agree on, but that means the OCC has to be one. It has to be a consensus process. Otherwise, the OCC will peel off and do their own set of rules. That would at least show where the accountability lies more directly. And I'm hoping that as the public is reminded by MF Global, as they're reminded by J.P. Morgan's recent fiasco, of why this is so important that traditional banks make loans and not make hedge fund investments.
Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure to join you.
All right, folks. Now... As you know, we continue our broadcast from Netroots Nation. Come. You want to say thank you again? I appreciate it. Guys, what you want to sit down and?
Sorry.
Hold on. Let's get Cliff Schechter in here. Are you done with this here? If you can, you gotta eject that. Bear with us, folks. We're at Netroots Nations, and hopefully they will stay quiet like this. We have Cliff Schechter and Gaius Pavlidis from we got. I'm gonna load up on two mics. Yeah, we're gonna try and double this baby up.
Okay, we're in the chair now.
Cliff, you can sit down, take a load off, as it were.
It were.
And let's see. Hopefully this will work. Bear with me, guys. Bear with me. So, first off, Gaius Pavlidis of America Blog, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Here, let me get you a little bit closer there with that microphone.
Does that work for you?
Yeah, that's great. And now we should have also Cliff with us. Cliff?
I'm here, man.
There you go.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I can hear you. That is shocking that I've been able to put this together. All right, so guys, give me your perspective. Cliff, of course, you're here every weekend, every Friday. Maybe I'll play your theme song at the end of
You know, whatever strikes your fancy, Sam.
Or we'll just sing it a cappella.
Okay, yes, we could. Cliff Schechter.
Scott Milliken's very good at singing it. He could try it.
Scott Milliken, producer of Ring of Fire, of course, a wonderful, accomplished singer. Let me get your take. I spoke to both of you guys last year at last year's Netroot Nation. Guys, give me your sense. How is this year's different?
This year's convention here?
Yeah.
Well, I understand. I've been asking around. I understand that attendance is up 10%, and it feels like it's down 20%. It just feels like a thinner conference. This is not critical. This is just the observation. The energy feels lower. The number of sessions I know is lower because I can count them. It feels quieter. I think there's a certain, honestly, a side effect based upon this is an election year with the president up for election. So there are sessions I expected to see that I didn't. For example, who could not fill a ballroom with a drone warfare session? but that's not likely to occur. And I think it gets, it just keeps people a little quieter. It just feels quiet to me. Last year was very lively. This, not so much.
Last night, well, Cliff, give me your sense.
I think that that's basically right. I think that part of it is coming off of what happened in Wisconsin to have this right after that. There's no doubt there's a hangover from that. I just think, and I don't want to take away because there's some people here talking about some great issues and that are fired up.
And great conferences, great sessions.
Great sessions, but yeah, you know, the overall feeling, I think that hit people hard. You know, what are you going to say? And so I think people are kind of...
Do you think there's anticipated, and you know, part of it is I'm just sitting here, and so I haven't had the opportunity to be in the sessions, but, and you raised this, Gaius, that do you think that there is some tension with people who want this to be about reelecting President Obama, and people who want this to be about issues that they care about, and have a problem with... full-on cheerleading?
The answer is yes. It's the kind of tension that occurs quietly in a marriage when people aren't talking to each other.
Oh, God, don't I know that.
but it's not... Ours occurs out loud.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, full-on fighting. Is that what you're saying?
Or at least honest discussion.
Right.
I don't see the honest discussion. The best political Obama-type discussion I saw was typically in the comedy session this morning with Cliff and Marcy and Liz Winstead and Shannon Moore and I don't know the other woman who was there.
Joy Williams.
But that was an honest discussion from the Obama side, the right Obama side to the left, Cliff and Marcy pretty much, discussing what's going on in Wisconsin and what the consequences were, with the point being made that, well, Obama didn't go to Wisconsin because he couldn't afford to appear weak. That's an electoral decision. And I'm thinking, yeah, but what about principle? And Cliff and Marcy made that point, and it was a good discussion. I don't see that anywhere else, and I don't see that people seeking that because they don't want to be confrontational.
Interesting. That's interesting. Cliff, the same? Or?
Yeah, well, I think you see the same thing play out here that you see out in the left in general in a year like this, which is, you know, it happens all the time, anywhere from blogs to Twitter to, I'm sure, your chat, your show, where there's some people that don't want to criticize Obama because it's an election year, and then there are other people that think, you know, we need to be critical when we need to be critical. And there's all sorts of perspectives in between. And so I think that kind of confuses some people because, you know, there are people that kind of don't know. They feel like, well, maybe I shouldn't say what I should say. I think if it's 2009, for example, you don't get held back as much by that. You know, but I think people, because it's 2012, some people sometimes get worried and think, oh, my God, you know, Mitt Romney and the rest. So, yeah, there's definitely that tension. And let's face it, look, you know, Obama creates even more attention because
right.
It seems like every other week or every, you know, whenever, he just does something else that frankly confounds me. I try to come on your show and have you be my therapist and, you know, figure it out.
We're mutual therapists.
Because to me, it doesn't make any political sense. It doesn't make any policy sense. I mean, again, the Wisconsin thing is another one of those things. Long term, you know, even if he's selfish enough to not want to help the Democratic Party there, long term, it hurts him. Long term, if there's momentum on the Republican side because of what he did, because of the lack of money putting the Wisconsin and the rest.
Wait, long term, you're talking about November?
Yeah.
Well,
okay. I mean, as opposed to, like, I don't want to look weak this moment.
Right.
You know, I don't want to look weak tomorrow. I don't want the news cycle to be against me for the next week.
Let's try and pretend, though, that 5 months out is not long term.
Okay, but
I understand.
Longer term, you know,
right.
two years, 4 years,
it's
bad on that level,
if
too.
If he's not president, it's 5 years.
Because there's an argument being, you know, there's an argument now, and there's a sort of, I don't like using the word war, there's a battle being fought on what rights workers should have and on where people should come down on public sector workers and unions. And if you're not putting out the correct discussion, conversation, narrative about that right now and trying to put the other side on the defensive, again, these things become long ingrained, you know, they get the rights so good at getting into our culture where people say, you know, I could say on issues I work on, everybody says, well, of course there's a lawsuit abuse problem and that's driving up healthcare. We got to do something about it. Because they keep saying it over and over again and we see the territory.
Is this a failure of the Obama administration or is this a failure of unions? In other words, there's been a couple of pieces out there. Doug Henwood wrote a piece. A guy named Yeltsin wrote a piece in the New Republic talking about how the unions are failing to make their case in exactly the way you're talking, in terms of that broader culture. That it may have been better for them to spend their millions of dollars, not that many millions, but they spent money in the primary and the general election in Wisconsin, going out, knocking door to door, saying, "Hi, I'm a teacher. I teach your kids. I'm in a union. Hi, I'm a, you know, I'm a, I collect your trash." You know, these unions are not bad. Where would we have been? I mean, what do you think about this?
Well, there's a general and a specific. The general problem is that there's two cleavages within unions generally. The first cleavage is the testosterone cleavage. That's I'll lay claim to that. There's a trademark on that one. It's the unions that represent bold manliness. It's the ones that went for Reagan, for example. It's the unionists in Chicago that hated the hippies. And that divide, it's why the cops beat up the occupiers, for example. We're manly. We represent testosterone culture, which identifies with Republicans. Those unionists are opposed to economic rights for all people because they have that cultural division. The other divide is between unions at a national level, which seem to be compromised because they need to cling to, in perhaps you could characterize it as a neurotic way or a dependent, codependent way with the Democratic Party to their mutual destruction, versus the ones at the local level, which are fighting for actual rights. And you can see an instance of that in North Carolina, where locals won't work that convention, the Democratic National Convention in a right-to-work state, and they're getting leaned on by the AFL-CIO to suck it up and join the fold. That's a cleavage within unions as well. And both of those mean that unions can't unite as a force for real, what you would go back to New Deal, trade unionism, and economic equality. The unions are neutered by both of those things, and I'm not sure that the direction isn't against them, unless they can reverse the momentum on both of them.
Well, I mean, how do they reverse that momentum if they can't even agree that that momentum should be reversed?
Exactly. I fully agree with you.
No, I'm looking for an answer. I want you to tell me how that's going to happen.
The answer is yes. You're right. No, it's going to be very hard.
The answer is that we get an army of like cyborg-like characters together. Okay, I'm not
going to
go any further. Go ahead.
My answer is to stop looking at movements that need to be built with a broad base, because I think that's very, very hard. And I'm a strong believer that we're facing deadlines. And look for things that small numbers of people can do where they have leverage. I'll take Joe Sudbay from our site, who got Obama in a room with a transcriber, a place where he couldn't get angry and he couldn't walk away, and he challenged him on gay rights. And that's the beginning of the end of the gay rights resistance at the Democratic Party. Joe was a hero, one man with leverage. I would like to ask Senator Merkley, would he be willing to deny unanimous consent on the last day of the Bush tax cuts when it comes up for the Senate and there's a deadline? One man with a position and boldness. That's the kinds of solutions I'm starting to look at. I'm not dissing grassroots organizing, but that takes forever, and I don't think we have time. We need somebody who's bold enough. You got a lever in your hand? Use it. Even if Pelosi yells at you. That's
my
answer.
We're not necessarily talking to people who have levers in their hand.
Well,
I guess you, I mean, how do people do that on a...
We do and we
don't,
Sam.
You're not a senator.
You just spoke with Senator Merkley. I'm not saying what you should do, but I'm saying a lot of us, I'm fortunate enough to have the platform at America Blog and to know people who have other platforms. There's nothing wrong with a group of us who believe in boldness getting together, figuring out where a leverage point is, and trying to apply it.
And it might have been Henwood's piece, I'm trying to remember, because one of the big things where he said how the AFL endorsed Obama early on, and therefore,
right.
I mean, that was a great point. In other words, I don't know all the specifics of what each union has done. Some have been more successful than others, so I don't want to paint too broad of a brush. But there's no doubt that they've been willing to kind of put down their agenda at times and just to jump on and be a part of the team. And the problem is, you asked if it's Obama's fault or it's their fault. It's everybody's fault, because
right.
Obama's not providing the leadership and hasn't really since day one. But if then you, so that you don't lose your place at the White House lunch, are willing to kind of, just subvert your agenda to keep him happy, it's kind of, it reminds me of of a letter from a Birmingham jail by Martin Luther King Jr. when he wrote about all the people said, now is not the time, now is not the time. Well, when's the time?
Great connection, you know? Cliff. Great connection.
Thank you. Well, it just makes me think of that. When is the time? Because Obama can keep telling them it's not the time, it's not the time. But you know what? They have to decide at some point. What are we down to, 12% unionship? We're almost 40% in the late 50s? I mean, when the hell's the time to stop that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very tough dynamic because in some ways the unions are trapped by what they do have. You know, it's a much clearer picture if you have nothing are completely at your lowest ebb.
Well, you know, the United States made changes at times when a whole lot of things collapsed at once. The last revolution we had was during the Great Depression. And it took a depression to get us to that point. So it's a scary thought, but that's certainly one way to get the outcome.
Yes, it's not guaranteed. It's not something you want to roll the dice with.
Oh, no, because you could get the...
Well, you end up with Father Coughlin, too.
Absolutely, right. And America First could have won the day.
But your point is still well taken. I still think those are obviously points of times when you... where things are broken down, structures are, and you can replace things. But I think there are other times where people can stand up and unite and push and join. And I just think you have to come to this consciousness of these are our interests, and if we have to lose something in the short term, the gain in the long term. I mean, guys and I were talking earlier about, you know, and I guess that I feel like this phrase is almost overused, but the shooting the hostage thing. Well, you know, sometimes maybe the Tea Party guys, whether it's a debt ceiling or whatever, they're willing to shoot a hostage. Hell, they'll take down a whole airplane. You know, it's at some point the unions have to, you know, be able to go to Obama and be like, guess what? You want to get reelected? Go to certain Blue Dog and other members of Congress. Guess what? You want to get reelected? You want our support? Here's what it's going to take. You know, instead of just sort of going along.
I think a lot of our goals is to not get to the point you're talking about and to be as effective as we can in the time we've got left so we don't have to see that day.
Well, I appreciate it, guys. Guys, Publius.
Thank you, Sam.
At America Blog. Cliff Schechter. I want to. You can hang out for a little bit.
I didn't get to have our casual. I didn't get to make any.
No, we
any
got time.
Jokes
we got, still got time. No, believe me, it's understood in everything you say. Everybody knows that's the subtext. But I want to talk to. I got Joe Sudbay here.
Why don't you bring Joe in? I'll shut up for a little bit. I'll come back.
Okay, great. I appreciate that. That's very nice of Cliff.
Yeah, it's very tough for me, as you know.
Joe, I turned off that microphone already. Joe Sudbay of America Blog. Great to see you, Joe. Thank you
Sam,
so much.
Sam, it's Mike. Always great to see you.
So we were here a year ago. Well, I mean, actually, I don't know if you remember that off-the-record session, so maybe it's not worth talking about the off-the-record session, but we've been at these conferences for quite some time,
right,
talking about these different issues. I have seen you question President Obama, and I know you have done it subsequent times about marriage equality. Last year we were talking about how is this going to push forward, and Gaius just mentioned you're sitting in a room with President Obama, interviewing him, and tell us about that story.
Well, it was in October 27th of 2010, the White House convened a blogger panel to meet with the president. There were five of us: John Amato from Crooks and Liars, Duncan Black, a.k.a. Atrios, Barb Morrow from Daily Kos, and Oliver Willis. And so we were told that the meeting was going to be on the record, and we'd get a couple, probably about 45 minutes with the president. And, you know, I have to say, I mean, it's pretty daunting, the whole process of, you know, realizing you're going to sit across from the president and that's going to be on the record. And also, we had been, at America Blog, we'd been pretty tough critics of the administration's actions on LGBT issues, particularly Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and they were still at the time defending the Defense of Marriage Act in the courts. And that wasn't the fierce advocacy we had been promised. So, our audience, our LGBT audience particularly, is pretty hardcore, and it's a pretty aggressive crowd. And I knew, you know, if I was going to go sit across from the president, I had made fun of a lot of people who went down to the White House and who just went to the parties, and, you know, you get there and you kind of lose your voice. So I knew I couldn't do that. But
it's an intimidating situation.
It's very intimidating. The whole process of going to the White House is intimidating. And the White House staff works it. All of them have done that. They understand that that's part of the process. And, I'm not a journalist. I was a blogger and an activist, so I spent some time preparing and had a couple of questions I wanted to ask. But when I started, I mentioned to the president that there was a lot of disappointment and disillusionment in the community. And then I asked him about don't ask, don't tell, and whether it was constitutional. He didn't really answer that, but he did tell me he didn't think the disillusionment and disappointment were justified. So I was sitting across from the table from the president, and he's like, and I'm like, oh, my God, I think he's, like, throwing shade at me. Yeah, I think he is actually throwing shade at me. Yeah, he did not. But then we get into a discussion about marriage, and that was actually that was pretty intense, too, because I had decided I was just going to make it personal, you know. I was right. And it was very important. That was when he said he was, you know, attitudes evolve, including mine, which was a big step forward, and which we pushed him on for the next year and a half. But I told him, and I thought it was important for you to say that you have to understand if the relationships that are most valuable to, most important to us, the relationships with the people we love aren't treated like everybody else's, we're not equal. And and several of the people in the room afterwards told me that they found that to be a very powerful exchange. A couple of my blogger friends, a couple of his staffers. So, and it was pretty intense. We posted the transcript, and it still kind of reverberates too. It's really interesting. That evolve quote really took on a life of its own.
Do you think that it came out after his announcement that he was going, I guess, to emotionally support marriage equality, which, you know, I'm not the significance of that, I think, is it cannot be overstated.
Right.
Do you think he was planning to do that anyway? I mean, that was the story that came out, right?
Yeah.
That after Biden forced the timing, but he was going to do that before the election anyways.
Yeah, I never thought it was going to happen before the election.
Would that even make sense?
Well, you know, what was interesting, because I was still pushing him to do it, and I wrote several pieces and did interviews, and I was often on my Signorelli show talking about it, and I wrote a post, 500 days after, it's 500 days evolve already, and I thought there was a good political argument for it. I actually think that, you know, I believe that most people when they're voting aren't going to vote on marriage equality. There are people on both sides who will, and the people on the other side are already not going to vote for him. I thought it would help him with young voters who are considered one of their prime target markets. In Virginia, you know, the Washington Post did a poll, I think it was last year, that showed for 18 to 29-year-olds, there's 73% support for marriage. So, and that's a group of people who need to be motivated again.
Right.
So I thought there was a very good, solid political argument for it. But I ran up against the traditional conventional wisdom. I mean, there were more than one time that I was quoted in an article where I'd be the one saying Obama should support marriage, and someone from the Human Rights Campaign, which is supposed to be the leading advocacy group for the community, would, you know, cut him some slack and say, well, he's been a great champion and he'll do it on his time. I do think the reaction has, it's played out much better than I could have imagined. The polling has been astounding, the new polling. And I will say, you know, yesterday we saw that Obama was outraised, 78 million to 60 million by Romney. It would have been a lot worse absent the gay marriage thing, because I think his fundraising probably spiked that day and continued to spike for a couple days after. I gave, and I hadn't given.
Now, let me ask you this. We hear a lot of a talk in the progressive community that your activism, specifically you, actually, are cited, but in general, the activism surrounding this issue should be the model for the rest of the progressive community when we're talking about economic issues, say. Do you think that it really is applicable? Do you think the fights are the same? Do you think the tactics are can be the same?
I think it's important for... yes, I do. I think it's important for activists... I think it's a question of how we view our elected officials. And do we consider them our friends or people we need to get things done? Sometimes they are our friends, but I see this particularly in D.C., where I live in D.C., and, you know, there is an aversion from advocacy groups to challenge their friends. And I think the first 2 years of the administration, there was a great deal of that. I think the Common Purpose meeting, which is held every Tuesday night, which Jane Hampshire famously refers to as the veal pen, was an example of how the administration tried very hard to, you know, rein in their allies and prevent them from going off the reservation. We chose a path of, I mean, I supported Obama, helped raise money for him, America Blog did. But we decided that it was more important for us to have equality than to have friends in the White House. And I didn't care if I got invited to parties. The access, I think there's something that happens in Washington that people want access. But they want access for the sake of access as opposed to having access for the sake of progress. And it sounds kind of craven, but I think I've seen it.
You have to be willing to lose it if you ever hope to use it.
Yes. And you know what? I pushed the president repeatedly. I did it publicly. I sat across the table from him, which is still amazing to me that I got to sit across the table from him. And I did it. And then, you know, and I'm no worse to wear for it. Amazingly, I got invited to the big gay party next weekend at the White House, which I'd never been invited to before. And I think it's kind of amusing to now be on that list.
Do you think that, so tactically speaking, that's an important lesson to learn. Is it the same hurdles? I mean, marriage equality and tell me if you disagree with me on this. I was talking to E.J. Graff today about this, and she, I think the way she put it was, and I'm paraphrasing, but the general gist of it was, that marriage equality is not fundamental. It's not an economic issue. It doesn't take money out of anybody's pocket. It doesn't diminish anybody's power. I suppose if you wanted to draw a very roundabout that somehow it may diminish the power of some evangelical minister somewhere, but probably not, probably strengthens his power in some respects. So that struggle is very different from other struggles that progressives need to fight going forward.
It is it's a different struggle, but at its core, it's about making change and making change in the right direction. And sure, I consider myself unequal because I can't get married the way everybody else can. But I think there's a huge amount of economic inequality that exists in this country that is harmful to people's very existence. And I think the people who have the opportunity to challenge authority need to do it to right that problem. It's a huge problem. And let's be honest, income inequality in the economy, the state of our economy is much more harmful to a lot more people than the fact that gay couples can't get married. But to me, it was very personal, and I think that was a big part of it. But I can't imagine that there aren't people whose lives are impacted every day who wouldn't be willing to, you know, take the fight where it needed to be to change it. So, it's different. But at the end of the day, what are you trying to do? You're trying to create progressive change.
So tactically, the tactics remain the same.
I think the tactics remain the same, yeah. I think it's really important to be willing to put some skin in the game and challenge your friends. I mean,
let me ask you before you go. Give me your sense of Netroots this year. Is it, you know, is it different?
I got in late yesterday, and every one of them has had their own personality.
Right.
You've been at all of them, I think.
Yes.
And I haven't figured out the personality of this one yet. It does. It feels different. I don't know how yet, though. So
interesting. All right, well, Joe, I really appreciate it. Thank
Sam,
you for stopping by.
It's always a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
And look at that timing. So, this is almost like a professional show. Well, Marcy,
I think I'm beginning to.
Sitting down with us right now is Marcy Wheeler from.
I don't know.
blog Empty Wheel. Oh, and Joan, will you sit down too with us? We're live at the moment.
Do you want me to actually pay attention that we're live?
Not necessarily. Marcy could do this in her sleep, folks. Marcy Wheeler, the blog is emptywheel.com?
.net. Somebody in Brazil is trying to steal my money and extort a lot of money for the .com.
Oh, really? Yeah. Are they trying to extort a lot of money?
No, they're just asking for money for it.
How much? Thousands of dollars?
Whatever it is, I don't have enough money. If George Soros would ever come through with that check, then I actually...
Have you not got your George Soros check?
No,
that's
I haven't
weird.
Got my George Soros.
I keep checking my mail, too. Joe McCarter of Daily Kos. What's your handle? Joan McSee? Is it Joan McSee?
It used to be. McJoan.
McJoan. Sorry.
Now I'm just
Joan.
Me.
Okay, that's all right. Give me your sense of Netroots this year. Well, not obviously, Joe was here and he said that everyone has a different personality. But give me your sense of sort of the mood and sort of or.
It doesn't feel as angry as last year to me.
Joan must be in different crowds
than
I'm in.
Yeah, I think I've been going to different crowds, apparently.
Okay, well, wait, no, finish that, and then I want to hear.
Feels not enthusiastic, more dogged. All right, we just have to get through this one more election. Not the enthusiasm you generally want to see, but I haven't seen the anger, not where I've been, so...
Marcy travels in slightly different circles.
Yes, and I didn't go to the Schneiderman keynote last night, so...
Well, I didn't go to the Schneiderman keynote either, but...
Well, but you did hear what happened. Tell everybody what happened.
I actually didn't hear what happened.
Oh, did you hear what happened?
Just briefly, I knew that there was going to be some protest before, because...
I think members of the PCCC...
Had placards.
Had placards that were criticizing the bankers.
Yeah.
How important do you think that was to send that message to Eric Schneiderman, Marcy?
Incredibly important. I mean, we were just sitting inside joking that nobody from the administration is here. Is that right?
That's right.
The campaign.
And somebody said, oh, but they're Schneiderman. That's the same as having the White House here. Because I really think... the other thing that I just got
explain
out
explain that.
Of-
explain that for people, because... let me just say that Eric Schneiderman, of course, appointed to this financial fraud task force, basically to the fear of many advocates that he was no longer going to be as dogged in pursuing financial fraud from New York. And when he signed on to the national deal, the deal was basically done. Biden then followed him, Harris in California, everybody followed him into that deal, essentially. And so his independence, you're questioning.
Well, I mean, first of all, DOJ has done absolutely nothing to hold the bankers accountable for blowing up our economy. You know, I normally cover terrorism. And if you look at the numbers, the amount of effort DOJ puts to terrorism, and you look at the effort that they've put to holding the people who stole trillions of dollars out of American people's pockets, it's unbelievable the difference. And actually, the numbers that the administration has on the crimes that they're seeing coming in, still skyrocketing on mortgage fraud, skyrocketing on consumer loan fraud. Terrorism is down. But nevertheless, there's an order of magnitude more effort focused on terrorism than on the bankers.
How are they recording that things like mortgage fraud are up if they're not pursuing it?
The Treasury tracks how many reports of suspected activities they get.
Okay.
Although they fired the guy who tracks that.
Just recently?
Just in the last 3 weeks. Reportedly because he wanted to focus on things like mortgage fraud, and the administration said, no, we need to focus on terrorism, which is going down. So he's the guy who records what they're getting in on the front end, and they fired him.
Well, I'm sure the FBI can drum up some new, can recruit some new would-be terrorists, right?
I mean, or the Saudis. I mean, the Saudis recruited our last terrorist. So.
There you go. Well, Joan, give me your sense.
Maybe we can get some hackers in there to start sending incriminating emails.
Hacking is going down, too. Hacking. This particular counting only counts hacking of banks, but that's going down, too.
We've got to turn the bankers into the terrorists somehow.
Well, even when...
Are they not already?
Because I love to bring this up, but do you know that J.P. Morgan Chase signed a deal with the administration for getting out of funding Iran and other terrorist groups? I mean, J.P. Morgan Chase violated all of these sanctions, some of them terrorism related. Did you hear a peep of that?
No.
So, in fact, Jamie Dimon is as much of a terrorist as half the people in Gitmo right now, and you wouldn't know that.
The Germans are providing material support for terrorists.
Right. I mean, you know, if he was Muslim, an entity, you know, the leader of an entity that provided a check to Al-Qaeda would go to jail. But Jamie Dimon is not only sending
Tell
money
us
to
more
run.
About this story, because, I mean, the fact is that if he was a Muslim and he was in and he was existing in Muslim circles, undoubtedly by now they would have brought him in. So tell us what this was.
It was just a settlement that they signed last summer, basically listing a bunch of things that, like sanctions against Iran, sanctions against Sudan. There was a terrorism-related charge in there. They got busted sending, I'm trying to remember, something like $200 million of gold bullion, transferring it for Iran. This is the kind of stuff, you know, Iran's supposed to be our biggest enemy right now, and Jamie Dimon's company was doing this, and they paid a big fine, but did anybody go to jail? Nuh-uh.
No, and I'm sure that they also didn't have to acknowledge any guilt, right? I mean, is there ever a moment when they pay those fines where they have to acknowledge guilt? I mean,
and actually one of the things, I have a suspicion, which is at this point just a suspicion based on court filings, that they were actually the bank that the scary Iran plot, the alleged attempt to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States, that the money went into a Chase bank in Manhattan. But I think that was after they had signed this deal, and so I think Chase is now cooperating with the government on all these terrorism plots. That's part of what they got done. That's a suspicion, but a well-grounded suspicion.
Interesting. Well, I have to say that, I mean, if people aren't reading your blog, you rarely, and I talk to reporters all the time, and you don't have a conversation. I rarely have a conversation where somebody says, "I was checking court filings." The level of reporting and investigative reporting you do, I think, is really unmatched online. I'm sorry for the tangent, but
she makes me feel like a biker, honestly.
And so, Joan, give me your sense of. Let's talk a little bit about Wisconsin. And let's talk a little bit about sort of the state of play with everything. There's a lot of Marcy, at the very least, is walking in those circles when it comes to issues of that where people are a little bit more upset. Give me the sense of what's making people most upset.
Well, I mean, I walk in civil liberty circles. Do you want a list?
No pun intended.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, you know.
I'm just curious. I mean, because, you know, we're hearing there's reason to be concerned that come the lame duck session, we're going to see some attempt at a grand bargain, and we're going to see Social Security sold out. We're going to see massive cuts to discretionary spending. And
on the way there, we could get a cybersecurity bill that essentially does away with every privacy right that we currently hold.
Right. Well,
without putting any obligations on the backbone companies and on corporate,
CISPA.
On corporate, well, whatever gets passed. I mean, basically, that they're not going to do the side that puts any kind of obligation on corporations. And corporations get a lot of immunity out of this
right.
in any case because, you know,
well,
you
they
want
get the immunity in the case of the House bill.
Yeah.
They well, I mean, be, but, yeah. here, but here's my point, though, is that, you know, you don't necessarily have to be sensitive to civil
right.
civil liberty issues to have your problems with the Obama administration. And there, now, there's
absolutely.
Often some crossover, but not as much. I mean, look, you know, I talk about drones and the kill lists and the sort of the lack of judicial review on my program, and I know it doesn't resonate with people in the
right.
same way that
right.
The idea that Social Security is going to go.
20% of mortgages being underwater does, and that is something where I think
right.
we've got a good beef with the Obama administration.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one area where Mitt Romney rightly could take Obama on and really do significant damage is on Obama's failure to do anything about the foreclosure crisis, anything. And he, you know, he would be right if he did that, because I think Mitt Romney actually has called to do more on the foreclosure crisis than Obama.
That's interesting. I mean, it shows you, I think, the power of the banks that Mitt Romney doesn't do it.
Yeah.
I mean, because he certainly, anybody in his position who has his background at Bain needs to campaign and redefine himself specifically in that area. And mortgage, some type of mortgage relief would be it. Even come, he doesn't even, to my mind, he doesn't even come out with any type of a convoluted fake plan. He hasn't come out with anything about that.
He's made a couple of comments, which is more, I mean, you know, it's just the
like it's bad.
The quote-unquote settlement is such an insult. It really is such an insult to both all of America that is struggling and losing their houses and losing their value, but also to the rule of law. I mean, banks are literally stealing people's houses, and his response is to give them a bailout.
Do you think that that ship has sailed? I mean, do you think that that Schneiderman's failure to do you think it's over with Schneiderman?
I
mean, are we just
I
watching?
I don't necessarily doubt Schneiderman's desire to do something about this. I really doubt his effectiveness, his ability. His hands are tied, essentially. This is a non-existent task force. It's him and some researcher
right, 50
out in
people.
California.
You don't do 50 people. You don't take on the biggest banks in the country with 50 people.
Do you think that he just got rolled and...
you know, if I had had a question to ask him last night, I would have asked him if he was client 13.
Really?
Making a joke about Spitzer. No, I mean, there's got to be an explanation for why
Wait,
you...
What happened to client 10, 11, and 12?
We'll probably find out about them in 6 years. No, I mean, it's like, I don't know why he caved, and I'm sure he caved because the leader of his party said, I need to have something to claim that I'm doing something on foreclosure. And I do think the ship has sailed because the statutes of limitation are tolling. And so,
well, specifically, which statutes of limitation?
Well, I mean, if you assume that these crimes have a 5-year statute of limitation, right? And I forget whether it's Mueller or Holder, FBI Director Mueller or Eric Holder, the Attorney General, were in Congress about a month or two ago, and somebody in Congress said, "Well, you know, you've got this task force now. Do we need to pass a law extending the statutes of limitation, basically giving the task force more time?" And whoever it was from DOJ is like, "Nah, we got plenty of time. We don't. I mean, the statutes of limitation are expiring already, because 5 years takes you back to 2007. That's already past the height of the securitization problems, and so
what about their testimony to Congress? I mean, didn't they go in and lie essentially to Carl Levin about what they knew about securities?
Right, and Carl Levin gave that to them wrapped up. What was it, a year and a half ago?
Yeah.
And what about the ongoing robo signing? Is that going to be a problem? I mean, that continues, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there was a whistleblower at Citibank who they actually did sue for that, and that was going on as recently as 2011, which she was whistleblowing about, and it was tied to rubber signing. It was tied to lying about the values of what Citi was passing through.
So basically, we just now got to wait until the next round crisis before, or what? I mean, is that?
I was at a really good panel that David Dayan did just before this keynote, and Liz Simoniak, who is one of the really key people on foreclosure fraud, said, you know, what's gonna begin to happen is these mortgage-backed trusts. So these investments that a lot of pension funds hold, a lot of insurance companies hold, all over the country, their performance rate is down to 30%, a lot of these. So in other words, you know, a big chunk of investment money in this country is about to go under because these houses, people aren't, you know, because they invested in foreclosure, and they didn't invest in foreclosure, they invested in mortgages, and those mortgages are never going to be paid off. So that's when the next crisis hits. It'll hit after the election, by design, but it will hit. And it'll mean, you know, it'll mean pension funds go broke, or it'll mean, or can't, you know, can't yeah. provide their what they're supposed to give, or it'll mean an insurance company gets bailed out, or it'll mean, you know, there will be another moment where we go, oh my gosh, this is a really terrible problem, and we won't do anything about it. And by the time we're at this stage,
do you think
again,
we'll see the Obama administration react in a different way at that time?
You know, he wouldn't be up for re-election. Yeah. He wouldn't be fundraising for the banks to the degree he is. But I still don't think... I mean, you know...
It's not a priority.
Yeah.
It's just not a priority.
Look, and I honestly understand people saying we've got to keep the global economy afloat.
Right.
And the elites collectively have chosen to keep the banks afloat and push austerity down on all the people. And I think that that was an ideological decision made at the very top to say, you know, we'll be more competitive with China if people make no money. We'll be more competitive with China if there are no unions. We'll be, you know, so this is the classic Naomi Klein moment, right?
Yeah.
Where they are using this opportunity.
They could have, shock doctor.
They could have bailed out the banks by just giving money to all the people who are underwater on their homes.
Right. In other words, they could have gone given relief directly to the mortgage holders, to the borrowers. They could have paid off. They could have they could have paid off the lenders and delivered the money that way.
Right.
That middleman would have solved quite a bit. Inserting that middleman, instead, they just gave it directly to the banks
and
hoped that it would flow out the other direction. And of course, there was no reason for that.
In the meantime, saving communities, keeping houses in good shape, keeping neighbors happy, keeping stores open, keeping neighborhoods functioning,
right.
Keeping people spending.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think they instead looked at it as opportunity, shock doctrine, right? So that they said, okay, what a great time to get rid of the unions. What a great time to get rid of Social Security.
Yep.
What a great time to get rid of Medicare. What a great time to get rid of all of these things that make that developed economies have come to make part of your social promise. And they're going to roll it up, given this opportunity. And, you know, I think that's where they want to head.
Well, hopefully they'll fail. I'm not sure how that's going to happen, frankly, but...
Isn't this a cheery place to
be?
See, now I made Joan upset. She was really happy until she started hanging out with depressing girl over here.
Well, Marcy Wheeler, Joan McCarter, thank you so much for stopping by.
And depressing you
Marcy.
And all your listeners.
Right. Good job.
Lunch with Simon Johnson yesterday.
What's up?
The next crisis is coming right around the corner.
Yeah,
so.
I was going to say, student loans are next.
Yeah, student loans are next, and Europe is still pretty darned scary. So. Yeah.
All right, well, we got to take a break, and we have a new sponsor. It's freeze-dried food. I'm joking. Thanks, guys. Now stepping up to the microphone. Stepping up to the microphone, of course, Ari Berman. Hello, Ari.
Hello, Sam. How was your night last night?
You know, I ran into Ari last night. Could you tell I was a little bit drunk?
Maybe just a little.
Yeah? Are you being facetious?
No.
Okay. Yeah, I was a little bit drunk. But of course, you know, someone my age gets a little bit drunk, goes back, watches the second half of the Celtics game, falls asleep.
unfortunately, I didn't, because...
Well, if you're a Celtics fan, it was good to fall asleep,
yeah,
because
exactly.
You didn't want to watch that.
No. Are you not a...
Well, I'm a Knicks fan.
Right.
So, that by process of deduction, I don't like the Celtics or the Heat, but now that they're playing each other, I just really don't want the Heat to win. So,
oh,
I'm
okay.
Now a de facto Celtics fan.
Fantastic. Well, that's going to make this a lot more, a lot less painful, Ari. So, Ari, give me your sense. You've been to a bunch of these, right?
It's only my second one.
Oh, really?
But I might as well just be at Nerds Nation every day of my life.
Were you last year?
Last year was my first.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. It seemed like an Ari Melber thing for a while.
You couldn't have too many Aries.
Yeah, if there was too many Aries in one place, the conspiracy is just gets
And
magnified.
Ari Melber not here.
Not here, yeah. It's a serious role
You really
reversal.
Will not come.
I am Mr. Netroots Nation. No, we were both here last year.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
And
I just never was asked to come. Last year was the first time they asked me to be on a panel. So, and this year I'm moderating a panel tomorrow on the war on voting.
And did you, did you do any really independent blogging?
Have I ever been a blogger? What do you?
No, I mean, you didn't have your own blog.
Well, I had a blog when I first started The Nation called The Daily Outrage, but it wasn't really a blog because it was basically an online column every day. So I've never, like, blogged.
At The Nation.
Yeah, At The Nation.
At The Nation.
Yeah, I've never had an independent blog, and I've never, like, blogged
like
Matt Iglesias.
Don't get so defensive about it.
It's a really sore subject, Sam.
I guess
so. I mean, you really pierced me hard here.
Wow. Ari, who knew? Well, give me your sense of what's going on. I mean, you know, like we have talked quite a bit on my program about what's going on in Florida. You weren't there, but I was basically quoting your Rolling Stone piece, and I think people are aware of that. You've done some great reporting on voter suppression, which seems to be... Well, let's talk about this for a second before we get to the Netroots. My sense is this is the one area where the Department of Justice does anything.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Well, they've been pretty active. I mean, they haven't been necessarily as active as they could have been, but they've been active in the sense that they have objected to laws in Texas and South Carolina, in Florida, under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which is the best power that they have. Now, they haven't used other sections of the Voting Rights Act to object to laws that are outside the South. So they haven't objected, for example, in Wisconsin. It's a different statute. It's very gets very complicated. But I'd say people who care about voting rights are reasonably happy with the Justice Department. It certainly would be a lot different if it was a Romney Justice Department versus an Obama Justice Department. And so this is an issue where people are pretty happy with Eric Holder. They've been pretty aggressive. And in Florida, you know, it was the election supervisors rebelled against this voter purge that Rick Scott wanted to do, and then DOJ stepped in, and that really solidified the ground that the election supervisors were on.
Now, but now, am I not right in that Lex Luthor and his beer-swilling henchmen, the beer lobbyists, that they're still trying to go forward with this voter suppression plan, even though you have, what is it, it's 57 counties? 27 counties.
67.
67 counties. These supervisors said, no, I'm not doing it.
The purge is basically dead. It's dead because the supervisors won't implement it, and if Florida defies the Justice Department is going to sue them. And so the combination of those two things basically means that at this point in time, Rick Scott's just pandering to the Tea Party, saying, I'm going to do this,
okay.
But I don't think he's going to actually be able to do it, because the election supervisors, they are elected locally, so they are independent authorities, and he can't force them to implement something. He can force them to send out letters to people saying, you know, you are not a citizen. That's what the letter said. They said, you are not a citizen, but you are registered to vote. Then the burden of proof was on the voters themselves to reply. But the election supervisors have flipped it. They said, okay, we're going to send out the letters, but if people don't respond, we're not just arbitrarily removing them
right.
from the voter rolls. We need to know one way or the other. And so they flip the burden of proof, and that basically means that no one's going to get removed off the voting rolls, according to election supervisors, who provides proof of citizenship or doesn't respond. The only way you're getting off the rolls is if you say, I'm not a citizen,
right.
which a few people have done. But overwhelmingly, you look at Miami-Dade County, where most of the people were targeted, 500 of them responded they were citizens, and 13 responded they were non-citizens on a list of supposed non-citizens.
Right.
So that's how ham-handed this purge
right.
was.
Right, and that's out of 1,600, I think, things that
that's
were
out
sent
of 1,600,
out.
And 1,000 right. just didn't respond one way or the other.
Right, like within, and it also has to be within 30 days, right?
Yeah.
I don't
we
think,
all
like,
get mail that we don't open,
oh
especially
God.
From the
kidding?
State. I mean,
yes.
the mail you get from the state, it's overwhelming.
It's overwhelming. Yeah. I have an entire separate mailbox for the mail I get from the state. Now, that's one half of the Lex Luthor and the beer guys' plan, right, in Florida. What's
yeah.
the other half? We have the voter suppression, kick people off the rolls,
yeah.
the purging of the rolls, and then what is the voter suppression?
Well, there's three other things he did, which were, one was an executive order to disenfranchise ex-felons who'd served their time. That they are disenfranchised now. I mean, that's not been overturned.
Is that, now, is that legal?
It's legal. He changed the order. Charlie Crist issued an executive order that granted the right to vote for nonviolent ex-felons after they served their time. On one of his first actions in office, Rick Scott changed it.
How is it that there isn't some broader federal statutory?
Election administration in the U.S. is very decentralized, and so every state has different laws.
And you don't need a statute?
There's not.
In the state?
Evidently, there's not like a federal right to vote for anybody in this country, including ex-felons. So he can do whatever he wants. Florida has one of the most.
The Department of Justice is able to go in and deal with this on the Voting Rights Act.
It's something that I believe it's something that he can do independently. That's
you
not
gotta look into this, sorry, because that does not make any sense.
Okay, I'll look
I mean,
into
it doesn't.
More. But when I looked into it at the time, it didn't seem like there was anything you could do about that. That was something the governor.
I don't know if you heard my interview with Marcia Wheeler, but she looks at court filings.
Oh, I look at court filings. Right. You should look at my desk. Then the other two things he did was he made it virtually impossible for nonpartisan groups to register voters.
Right.
That has subsequently been struck down by a federal judge, and those groups like the League of Women Voters and Rock the Vote have resumed voter registration activities.
Now, but they lost a lot of time, right?
They lost a lot of time. I mean, absolutely.
But a year.
They lost a year. And we know, compared to 2008, 80,000 fewer people have registered in Florida. Now, that could be for a confluence of factors, but clearly the voter registration shutdown was part of that. The other thing they've done is they've cut back early voting from 14 to 8 days and banned it on the Sunday before the election when African-American churches historically mobilize their constituents. That those two things, the voter registration and the early voting things, are being challenged under the Voting Rights Act. So it could still play out. There's a lot of different factors here in terms of the legal part of it.
But on balance, plot failed, right?
On balance, the voter plot failed, and the voter registration thing has thus far failed. The early voting cutback and the disenfranchisement of ex-felons is still in effect.
I just want people to take a moment and contemplate this for a moment. Of all places in this country, of all states in this country, the fact that he has the capacity, 10 years later, 12 years later now, after 2000, to cut down on the length of time that you can get your absentee ballot in there. And people in Florida are not, like, literally hanging this guy in effigy. I mean,
well, he is the second most popular governor in the country, to be fair. And there's no recall process in Florida, so there's nothing anyone can do about it.
Second
most unpopular.
Most unpopular, right.
The other way of saying it is he's the second
but
least popular.
It's just stunning that he can get away with this. Like, the problem is we did not embarrass Florida enough.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Rick Scott has been very unpopular pretty much since he took office, but he hasn't been turned into kind of national villain.
But
the
we
same
didn't
way.
Obviously embarrass Florida enough in 2000.
Well, clearly not, because listen, they tried a voter purge like they did in 2000 and 2004. The public outcry stopped it. Then they tried again, and the public outcry stopped it. So the public outcry has stopped voter purges twice now, but they did get away with stealing an election. I mean, you look at people think of the Supreme Court and think of the Hanning Chads, and that was all incredibly screwed up. But 12,000 eligible voters were not able to vote because they were labeled as felons in Florida. 41% of those were African-American. That's three times the number of African-Americans in the state. And you look at African-American voters in Florida in 2000, they favored Gore over Bush by 86 points. So if even a fraction of those people had voted, it would have been more than the 537
right.
votes. 12,000 people people's 22 times what the margin of victory was for George W. Bush. So there's no way to look at this and conclude that Bush legitimately won the election if you take all the factors and if everyone could have voted, number one, if they counted the ballots that of people who had voted, but number two, if they hadn't purged the voter rolls, Gore would have won Florida. And it's irritating to think about. Like 12 years later, I still get mad about it.
Slightly irritating. Fortunately, it's competing with other irritating things to think about. So
There's no shortage of irritation.
What do you got that's good? We ain't good news.
Well, I mean, that is. I just gave you two pieces of good news. The voter purge is dead, and groups are registering voters. I mean, I'm on the democracy is being subverted beat, Sam, for the last year. I mean, there's not a lot of good news in what I'm doing. So this has actually been a pretty good news week as far as my reporting goes.
Hold on for a second. We're going to have to play. I'm going to have to play some positive music off of that because we need this. Are you kidding? Here we go. There we go. Wait a second. Do you have headphones?
No.
Can't hear it.
I can only...
But it's all those kids in Sound of Music when they're going up on the hills. All right, and they're doing the, the puppet show.
I know you've seen that movie like 20 times, so.
Yeah, you know my kid. You've met my daughter. You know I gotta watch
She's
it.
Quite a character.
Yeah, she is quite a character. Not necessarily always a heroic character. Sometimes a villain.
Yeah.
Right? All right. Well, give me your sense of the mood here at Netroots.
So I think the mood is hard to characterize, I think. I don't know what your sense of it is, but I don't think it is any one thing anymore. I mean, I think the Netroots itself is more diffuse than it's ever been. I mean, it's weird. We're in an election year. It's already June. No one really seems to be talking about the election. No one really even seems to be talking about
fascinating, isn't it?
Either
candidate. I haven't heard any conversation about the election.
People are talking about systemic problems. I mean, this is the same, it's not the OWS frame, but it's a corollary to that, which is people are talking about dark money, they're talking about super PACs, they're talking about voting restrictions, they're talking about all these things that are undermining our democracy. That seems to be like the broad theme to me of the conference. And there's very few politicians even here. I mean, there's some senators going around, Elizabeth Warren is here, but it's not like people are done with politicians, I think. I think people realize.
Well, there's never been that many politicians that have come here. And, you know, I think, like, even, but I will say this. Usually what we see here are congresspeople, guys running for Congress. Primary, I haven't seen one. Now, it's only day 2.3, but I haven't seen one.
Well, there's two ways of looking at it. Number one is that everyone just views this conference as irrelevant. Or the second thing is that it's more relevant than it was, and so the organizers don't feel a need to invite a bunch of politicians here just for the sake of having them.
But there's other stuff going on. That the centralization of fundraising has changed. That it used to be, I want to get all the Netroots, but now there's probably like a half a dozen big blogs. If you're a congressperson trying to raise money, that you will hit and hope a couple follow.
And the media is not here. I mean, there's no major candidates here except for Elizabeth Warren. There's no major Obama surrogate, so the national media is not here, which is very different than it was in Minneapolis, for example, when there was a ton of media.
Right.
It doesn't seem like people care that much about what's happening here, which I don't think makes it less important. I think it will make it in some ways more meaningful.
I agree with that. I think the biggest problem with this conference is when they put themselves in a position to sort of want that approval. And I think it weakens what's happening here. And I think this is a period of time where the Netroots are sort of like really trying to suck it up.
You know? Yeah, people, I think, are fairly introspective. I mean, not only, you know, are you dealing with all the fallout of 2008 and the diminished expectations for the president and Democrats in Congress, but then you're also dealing with the fallout from Wisconsin. I mean, I think if, you know, Scott Walker had been recalled, there would be a different energy level here than there is now. And just, you know, everyone, either on your show or everyone, what they've been covering, I mean, it's just, we've just been inundated with bad news. And so, and we are in this weird period where it doesn't really feel like the economy is getting better. No one knows what's going to happen in the presidential race. And it's hard to have a definitive opinion, really, one way or the other. So it's just, it's good for 2,000 people to get together and drink a lot.
How well are we going to make a bet? You know, this audience is very familiar with our famous bet that you lost back in, I guess it was February of 2008. I think I have it down in my calendar. I don't know the exact day. I think it was probably the 21st. And we went to an event.
Steve
Clemens.
At 11 Madison Park.
Yes.
Which has since become the best restaurant in New York, evidently.
It was a very fancy restaurant. We got invited to, I can't remember what talk it was.
Oh, it was Zalmay Khalilzad, the UN ambassador under Bush.
Right. And
very bizarre night, as I recall.
That was very strange. And, oh, that's right, yes. And we heard him talk, and then we went out for a drink. And I bet you, or you bet me, but I think I bet you, $200. $200. This is not chump change. It may be in the circles you run in, but not in my
circles. Adjusted for inflation, that's like thousands of dollars.
Back at the time, yeah. Back at the time, it was chump change for me. It wasn't a sort of like, I was still in my sort of...
That was street money for you.
That wasn't even street money for me. That was street money. That was money I would get to access my street money. You understand what I'm saying? And so, I bet you, in February now, that Obama would win 52-48. And I don't even think he had just maybe, it was pretty clear he was going to lock up the nomination, but he hadn't officially. And I was exactly right.
It was a bold bet. That's true. I would love for the president to get 52% of the vote again.
What do you make? Well, I think he actually is going to, but.
What's the bet going to be? I mean, or what would you take?
I would do basically double or nothing, but I actually think it could even be higher than 52.
No, that's no way. No way. The polling is not very good right now. I mean, it's hard to read one
way.
It's for either person. I mean, it's hard to read one way or another. There was a column by Jonathan Alter today in Bloomberg News, who is always an Obama defender. He consistently, he said Obama's numbers are going to keep falling through the summer, and he needs a new message, and he needs a new jobs plan, or else he's going to lose. Now, for Alter to say that, that made me really, really worried, because he's always one of the guys that's trying to tell me, oh, things aren't going to be as
bad.
I'll
tell you, if Alter's saying that, it suggests to me that the president has already got a plan to do that.
Well, yeah, that would also.
There's another way to explain what the guy who wrote the bio, who's a big defender, when he writes something like that, there's two ways to read it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. But you look at the fact that the economy alone is enough of a difficulty for Obama now, and then you add all the structural factors in the super PAC money, the voting restrictions, all the third party groups, and it's uphill. I mean, I'm not saying he shouldn't be favored, but I basically think it's 50-50 right now.
What do you think about all of the progressive ambivalence towards voting for President Obama?
I think it's stupid.
Why?
Because I think clearly there's a huge difference between Obama and Mitt Romney. I think there's a huge difference in what they would do in foreign policy. You might not be crazy about what the president is doing, but he's not angling for a third war like all the people around Romney are, who are just dying to get back in power and resurrect the first term of the Bush administration, which I wrote about. And then you look at the Supreme Court. I mean, Romney's going to put one or two more justices on the Supreme Court for the next 30 years. That's going to completely obliterate every gain that was made from the New Deal, from the Great Society. They're going to shred all of it. I mean, those two issues alone, to me, are enough of a reason to say there's a major difference between the candidates. Now, I don't think Obama is perfect by any means. We've had a lot of conversations about it. But I just think, number one, not voting, given all the new voting restrictions, not voting to me is really angry when so many people are fighting so hard just to be able to vote. And then the second thing is, if you don't vote, that's just creating a void for someone else's vote to matter more. And those are going to be people
right. There's no such thing as not voting. If you do not choose to exercise your right to vote consciously, you are basically providing a half vote for the winner. Yeah. That's the fact. I mean, this is a very simple equation.
I mean, I think you should vote and pressure. I mean, why would you just pressure and then not vote? I mean, it doesn't make sense to me as a strategy. I mean, I understand. I agree with a lot of the critique of Occupy Wall Street. I understand the system is important, but not voting is just going to make it harder to fix the system, not easier. Because the people on the right are going to fill the void. Someone's going to fill the void if you don't vote, and it's going to be people on the right.
Ari Berman, you are wise beyond your years. And
I'm 30 now, so I'm getting up there in my years.
Oh, my God. Oh, I didn't realize you were that old. You're wise, but not necessarily.
I'm no longer a rising star. I'm sort of a has-been.
No, dude, don't believe me. You got to wait till you get to be my age. Then you'll see what it's like to be.
I still
contend not a has-been, still arguably a never was. I don't know.
Never made it, you mean?
I think I was just about there. In about three different professions.
Didn't you have a show with Janine Garofalo once?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, yeah.
At one point, yeah.
So you're pretty important.
I also
want to give you some props for coming here every year, bringing all the gear, lugging it around.
We were the first. Somebody just reminded me, we were also the first video feed.
Yeah.
Of this. We were also the first audio feed. I mean, a lot of that, actually, Josh Orton has to take credit, but I hired him. You know what I mean? If it wasn't me, Josh Orton would be somewhere, I don't know, working
at give you a percentage
working
of
at a Stewart's and outside of Madison. that is our program today. Ari, thank you for joining
Always
us.
Always good to see you, Sam.
Ladies and gentlemen, I will. We're going to have a ton more interviews for you next week that I've been doing here, including interviews with E.J. Graff, with Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, interviews with Senator Sherrod Brown. Basically, only doing interviews. Well, I guess with that didn't work out. Who else? I'm going to be talking to Heather Hurlburt and Matt Duss. I'm going to be talking to, a ton of other people. Those interviews will be available over the course of the week, mostly to members, and hopefully, in fact, some of them will be available to other, to the freebies, but mostly to members. I'm sorry, I'm posing for a picture right now, so I've got to have it. Long Doggy gets the first and last. I am of the day. Ambivalence about voting for Obama is not stupid. It's not about letting the right win. We need to play a little chess of our own. Obama needs to feel our ambivalence and believe and change. Believe it and change his policy. There is still time. We just can't let him and the Democrats count us eggs as his chickens. I'm not a damn chicken. Interesting way of saying that. All right, folks, none of you are chickens. I appreciate your sticking around. So, folks, I will see you live Monday. And I do mean see because... Of course, we'll have our Ustream up and going. I'm now going to continue to interview people, not live. All right, folks. See you then.